Hello and welcome to the Rights and Rule podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. I'm Jimmy and I'm one of the deplorables who voted to leave the EU in 2016.
I'm Jazza and I've taken to finding solace in Leila Moran, the Liberal Democrat MP, and her tweets pontificating about the possibility of Theresa May making no deal look so bad that the British public will eventually turn on her and demand that we stay in the EU. It's a convoluted dream that I have,
yeah,
but
it's very real for me. It's optimistic.
I need to be. I have nothing else.
Okay.
We meet weekly to talk about politics, social issues and current events. This week we're joined by John.
Hello.
You've been on the podcast before. Introduce yourself for anyone who's listening for the first time.
Hello, I'm John. I'm a human person.
Are you though?
Ostensibly human views sometimes. If you catch me on a good day.
What do you do in...
I assumed that people knew that you were going to be a human.
What do I do in daily life? I try to write things. I'm a playwright and screenwriter.
There you go.
Aspiring, mainly.
Aren't we all?
I mean, I've had some stuff out there. I'm on the BBC if you...
Okay, I'm cutting this short now. Jimmy, what are we gonna talk about today?
What are we going to talk about today?
Okay. You literally have the notes in front of you.
It's difficult, though. Okay, so the first topic that we are going to be discussing is this report that Oxford and Cambridge are shockingly, in quotes, even posher than previously suspected. I don't know how people measured it previously. I just think people just assumed that Oxbridge was really posh, and it is really posh.
Well, it's meant... I need to stop having topics on this podcast that implicate me. Because when I worked at Facebook, we talked about Facebook a lot. And I'm just very happy that none of my bosses
We can start doing that again.
It's fine. And now that I'm at Oxford, I feel like I'm going to have to end up defending the place, even though...
It's a bastion of privilege.
It really
is. And white
is.
Supremacy.
I mean, as a privately educated, white, southeastern man... Oxford is apparently made for me. But there have, like, some of the revelations are genuinely quite shocking. Like, in 2015, a third of Oxford colleges didn't award a place to any black British pupils. And that kind of... David Lammy, the Tottenham MP, has called it a kind of social apartheid. And we're going to be chatting about that, and I'm probably going to feel very uncomfortable.
Good. That's nice. For our second topic, we are going to be covering the allegations that there was dirty Russian money involved in the Brexit campaign. There's been an investigation that was published on Open Democracy, which alleged that Aaron Banks, who's the sort of famous gobshite who's part of the Leave.eu campaign, who pumped a lot of money, $12 million allegedly, into various Brexit initiatives, was not quite as rich as he claimed, sort of in a very Trump-esque manner. And the insinuation, at least, is that Russia maybe, through back channels, managed to pay money to campaign for Brexit.
I mean, this isn't new thought.
It's not new thought. But
so there's new data that's come out and published in the Social Science Computer Review by a team of researchers at City University London. And it looks like there are several thousand Russian-based bots, by their estimations anyway, that were being used in the run-up to the referendum and now have been deleted.
Fun stuff.
Yeah.
And third, John, you might as well introduce this since you suggested
the
it.
The third topic is the reports that Cambridge University students are now getting trigger warnings on people including Shakespeare, Sarah Kane, Samuel Beckett. We're going to discuss whether or not trigger warnings on certain texts are a good idea.
What are trigger warnings?
Trigger warnings for people who don't know. I mean, there are two versions of it. Originally, trigger warnings were used in the mental health profession to help people who had mental health issues. It's now been more widely used in the sort of social context for just anything that might be a bit upsetting or distressing, arguably. So we're going to tear that one apart later.
Broadly, John thinks that they're a bad idea, and I think they're quite a good idea. So let's set up this drama. Let's play some music. I'll beg for money and thank the people that have succumbs to our begging for money. And we'll continue with this after that, shall we?
Yes.
Good. Hello dear listeners, Jazza here. You know the drill by now. We are running a Patreon because it takes a lot of time, effort and our own money to be able to put together these episodes more or less weekly. It would be fantastic if you would be able to donate, like even just a dollar. If you think that what you are listening to is worth a dollar, then we'd love to have you as a patron. That would give you access to our feed where we have outtakes, extra extended interviews, and the like. It's actually some of the best audio content that I've ever created, to be completely honest, is now accessible only to patrons. We would like to thank Gemma, Matt and Dominique for being our current patrons. Thank you so much, guys. Your pins are coming to you very soon. But without further ado, let's get on with the show. Thanks a lot, guys. So, shock horror, Oxford and Cambridge are pretty damn posh, despite the fact that they are meant to have been trying to expand the different types of people who end up going to their university. There has been some data released specifically from Oxford. Cambridge readily made it available last year. Oxford have only just released it. That paint a pretty damning picture. As some examples, one in three Oxford colleges, there are 32 Oxford colleges, failed to admit a single black British A-level student in 2015. Four-fifths of students accepted into Oxbridge between 2010 and 2015 had parents with top professional and managerial jobs. London and the South East received 48% of offers to Oxford and Cambridge. Oxford only made about 100 offers to students in the whole of Wales last year. And there are more Oxford offers made to students from Eton than students on free school meals across the whole country. But I feel like it's the students' fault for not being smart enough, right?
Fucking
hell. Cool. Well, we'll end that topic there.
I mean, what is the ultimate goal from your point of view? Because to my mind, in a capitalist society, money is always going to gain you some advantage at gaining access to elite institutions. And frankly, intelligence is very heritable. And it is likely that you get pools of like different classes of people, like smarter people end up having smarter kids who end up going to universities and getting better jobs and then have smarter kids themselves and so on and so forth.
Oh, shit.
No, I mean, intelligence is super fucking heritable. It's one of the most widely agreed facts about heritability.
I'm not sure that is widely agreed.
No, it is. It's super. It's very widely agreed.
Hold on, we've descended. The figures don't talk about like how many intelligent people are going to Oxford and Cambridge. They're talking about how many people of privileged backgrounds are going to Oxford and Cambridge.
I know, you missed me. You missed my...
You can be working class and be incredibly intelligent, but not manage to...
These are about broad-based generalisations. So yes, it is true that you can have very stupid parents and be a fucking genius.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is totally possible. Uh-huh. My point is saying if you're talking about distributions...
So there may be some truth into that. I would love to see the data that supports that.
I mean, it's not really data. It's just, you know, it's long, you know, trails of social science, really.
Which should be backed up in data if it's a social science. But I struggle to believe that there are more eligible people going to Eton than in the rest of the whole country. Who are from poorer backgrounds,
yeah.
who are intelligent enough to go to Oxford. That is a insane statistic that is clearly not representative of any inherited intelligence that any of these kids
have. No, I think it is probably partly representative of inherited intelligence. The degree to which you can argue it is certainly disputable, and, you know...
That is not the case.
What is the end goal? Like, to go back to the original question, what is it that you want to see that these statistics don't currently show?
I mean, intelligent people should go to Oxford and Cambridge, not people who come from privileged backgrounds. What our education?
But my point is that they're in a capitalist society, you will get some correlation between privilege and inherited intelligence.
There is not a correlation. At the moment, all that's happening is people with money are sending their kids to expensive schools.
And giving them expensive schools that have specific training so that they know what
they
to expect from the
exams.
So the specific things that some of our listeners won't know is that Oxford and Cambridge have a very quirky interview system that is only mimicked across a handful of universities still in the United Kingdom, where often they're kind of branded as quite weird and out there. There was a girl at my school 10 years ago who had a coconut thrown at her in her history in an interview to go and study history at Oxford. And like apparently those kinds of things happen, but what they are trying to do and what Oxford is meant to be really proud of putting forward is the idea that they accept people based on their potential, not that you are at the point of being able to change the world now, but that one day you might possibly be able to end up changing the world. There was a lovely quote about that from one of the admissions tutors this year when they released some sample questions of what the interviews were like. But this clearly paints a picture that at least at the undergrad level, is not true. I will say that as a postgrad at Oxford, my experience is incredibly different. I have a much more diverse group of students around me because as a postgrad, we have a lot more international students. My school specifically tries really, really hard to have more of a...
These numbers, by the way, they were just from like UK-based citizens.
Yeah, so this was based on undergrad experiences, which are like vast majority are...
Well, but even so, they discounted the international students for the purposes of the stats, as far as I'm aware.
But possibly...
But I mean, to return to the original question, what is it that you want?
I would like there to be more diversity of thought, of background, and of experience represented in what is one of the best schools in the world.
But diversity of thought and demographic diversity are two different things, and these stats show demographic diversity.
We disagree on this a lot, but I think it's very difficult to have diversity of thought if you do not have demographic diversity.
It is unlikely that you would have diversity of thought without demographic diversity, but it is certainly possible.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. Yeah. But I think also there is a... it is part of the job of publicly funded universities to ensure that they do a public good, and that includes making sure that people from diverse backgrounds are able to go to these institutions, and that clearly isn't happening, and they hide behind the guise of, oh, the state schools or the poorer areas are just not creating the students that are intelligent enough to hold the workload and all those kinds of things. And I'm sorry, that's not...
I don't think that's the position. The position is that they have a process of like recruiting students effectively, and there are some groups that are far fucking better at gaming that process and actually winning access to the institutions.
So that process needs to change, right?
I don't know.
So you're asking what my end goal is. I think that they need to put their money where their mouth is and actually have a system that does identify the potential of people. I actually quite like the idea of the Oxford interview system. I never had to go through it myself. But because it kind of abstractly takes you away from the grades that are so easily gained by the fact that people have like tutors who like parents are able to pay for tutors and all of that kind of thing. And from what I understand about the interview system, they are able to use more of a qualitative attitude towards the type of intelligence that is portrayed in the people that apply for these things.
But surely, I mean, it's not just the case that students who go to private schools, for instance, are being taught how to game an interview system. They are in some...
Sorry, what?
It's not... If you're privately educated, you are... I mean, for instance, me and John went to the same private school, and we there was actually a specific sort of extracurricular Cambridge or Oxford interview...
Yeah, no, I had the same thing.
Interview prep, right?
Apparently, the one at my school was completely different to what actually ended up being.
I'm
not talking... That obviously exists, but it might also be the case that the sort of qualities that are searched for in those quirky interview processes are qualities that private school kids have in greater abundance anyway.
That's probably also part of the problem.
Well, for instance, if you're poorer, you do worse across, like, basically every kind of life outcome that you could care to mention, mm-hmm. because you're just subject to more stress. You're more likely to be raised in a single house that's the product of a divorce, for mm-hmm. instance, or you've got greater chance of health problems, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. And all of those things will actually pare down to you just appearing to be a less, or maybe even just functionally being a less suitable person, because your experiences through childhood do affect your potential through life.
I see what you're saying, but actually I think that feeds into the criticism that I have, that actually people from those types of backgrounds shouldn't be shunned away. That means that the university needs to have better resources for people from underprivileged backgrounds, where they are going to be more likely to have external stresses, where they are going to be more likely to have mental health.
But I'm saying, if you're looking for potential, whatever process you go through and do that, if a person's early life experiences, for instance, if they were poorer, have made it appear as though they have less potential, you can't particularly blame the people doing that screening for not seeing the potential if it doesn't appear to be there.
But then they say that they have a process that allows them to see that potential.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's the hypocrisy
they claim, but like I'm saying, you can't design a process for seeing potential that totally discounts all of the like demographic privilege factors.
But that's what I think the problem is, that they say that they maintain this somewhat archaic and quirky system in order to be able to bypass stuff like rate inflation and stuff like people being able to get tutors.
I mean,
the
other thing is, you say it's archaic. It's not that quirky. Like, I went through a
having a coconut interview. Thrown at you is fucking quirky.
Well, yeah, but I went through a Cambridge interview system. I mean, actually, I didn't know I was a disabled student at the time. So
dyslexia.
I didn't know that when I applied. So had I known that when I applied, it would have been a whole different system of application. Mm. There was nothing quirky about any of my applications. They were all quite similar to jobs. You go along and you're asked sort of fairly penetrating questions. You might write an essay or two.
Were you interviewed for Warwick then?
Yeah.
How did the two interview processes compare?
The interview for Warwick was disgusting and horrible. I hated it. I came out thinking I hadn't got in.
Were they similar interview
Yeah,
styles?
Very, very, right. very, okay. very. They were both very sort of harsh and, you know, forward and yada, yada, yada. But I didn't think they were fucking quirky at all. Mm. Nothing about them made me think, oh, wow, these are out there sort of progressive thinking people.
But like for me, I went to Manchester, and there's nothing like that. It's all just written applications, and
is worse. I think it's worse because you don't get any feel for the people who might be sitting in front of you.
I will say Manchester, which is a top level Russell Group university, is way more diverse in terms of where people come from, in terms of how it looks, than Oxford is. And so you're saying that the systems are clearly the Manchester system is worse, but Manchester University still seems to be able to have a more representative pool of students than Oxford.
I mean, actually, maybe my assertion is completely wrong. Maybe by removing meeting somebody to face to face, you make fairer decisions.
I feel like this is kind of a little bit of a red herring. It's not the process that is the problem. It is how people are being selected, and it's the people making those selections.
That is process.
No, it's not. So you can go through the same process and the person making the decision can come to a different conclusion.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It's something
But somebody needs to make a decision.
No, but this goes back to something that you always talk about in terms of hiring practices.
Right.
The fact that, white middle-class people are going to tend to employ white middle-class people.
Yeah, there is
a
tendency to do that.
If you have professors who are white and middle-class looking at students, they're probably going to favour the white middle-class
students. But this is the argument for, like, temporary quotas, basically, is that you go for a generation where you have quotas and then you take it away.
I haven't mentioned the word quota once.
No, you haven't mentioned it, but people do. It's not all about you, Jazza. Other people do have opinions in this area.
I don't know. I haven't gone to Oxford, but presumably there are...
Oh, it's lovely this time of year.
Presumably there are professors who are... people of colour.
But not many. I think that's part of the problem.
Surely they should be part
of the... And I think that there is also the culture of people from less economically affluent areas. And,
poorer areas, in English.
Or poor areas. Less economically affluent areas. Or people of colour communities. Or like state schools, where people just don't have Oxbridge put on the table for them. It's not that they're discouraged from applying, but they don't even know that, there is even a possibility of them being able to go through that process and being able to be competitive in that. And I think that is a problem in the school system. But ultimately, the universities need to stop passing the buck onto the government and the policies that they have when it comes to education and outreach, and to the institutions, the schools that send them the students, and saying, well, you should send us higher quality students, which is what has been a criticism that we've heard and listened to.
Dr. Samina Khan said on the Today programme this week, that essentially, I've got the quote here, it's a question of proportion rather than raw numbers, which point to a pipeline issue. Fuck off.
Drain cleaner that will sort that out.
But isn't she right that ultimately they are reliant on the schooling processes that lead up to the end of
She was quite specifically asked on the Today programme, if you have somebody coming from a working class background who gets, say, all Cs, and proportionately that's quite impressive considering how the school's done, should you not favour them over somebody coming from Eton?
So are you saying there should be some sort of waiting process?
And she essentially said no.
Now, wait, are you saying there should be some sort of waiting process?
Of course there should be. I believe most universities do have a waiting process.
So like an A from a shit comp is valued more highly than an A from a private school?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
There is...
But if they're already doing that, it doesn't appear to be having the desired effect.
No, clearly.
But I mean, they're doing it on...
Which is why it's clearly their problem.
They're kind of doing it on the level of like, oh, well, if you got an A from a comp, then you're better than an A from a private school. They're not doing it sort of, you got a B from a comp, so that's more impressive than an A from a private.
And it doesn't actually follow that a student who got an A from a comp is necessarily better than a student who got an A from a private
school. They supposedly have these quirky interview systems, but also it should be able to discern.
So there is an institutional system of discrimination against privately educated people, and yet it still doesn't appear to be having
because it was easier for you're saying it's discrimination against privately educated.
I mean, it is discrimination, Jazza. That's just a matter of definition.
Yeah, no, of course, but often that is used as an argument not to do it, and I think that actually it certainly is
an argument
that
not
should
to do
be
it.
Done.
It is an argument not to do it.
I don't think so at all.
But it's usually not the child's choice to end up at a private school.
Sure.
And yet you are still choosing to discriminate against them.
If the goal of a university system is to produce like the leaders in fields in the world, you want the people who are entering that system to have the highest possible potential that they
can.
You've
already agreed that your system doesn't necessarily, as you say.
By my system, do you mean Oxford's?
Well, yeah, the weighting system where you weight different the same grade differently depending on what context it came out of. You've already admitted.
No, but you're saying it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody is smarter who goes to a comp and gets a C.
It doesn't necessarily mean.
But then I feel like it is more likely that somebody who gets an A at a comp is going to be more capable and smarter than me who went to a private school and got an A.
If they're in a system that
doesn't have the resources that I had and gets the same grade as me, they are almost definitely better than
well you you don't period. Know that because the test to check that out would be to take the A student from the private school and put them in a comp of equal caliber and then see how they do.
But
that
unfortunately
would be how you test that.
Ethics will probably not allow us to do that, and I think that intuition shows
and
that
time,
that would probably
It doesn't matter what your intuition like
to kind
finds
of,
like the
no,
logic
no,
doesn't
but
work.
How can no but how can you not agree that somebody getting an A in a comp is clearly a greater achievement than getting
can,
an A
wait,
in private
can I just ask him a
do you,
I mean,
do you
no,
agree that that's
all,
true?
All else held equal, yes, but we are not holding all else equal. These are two different students.
Yes, they are two
right,
different
can
students.
I,
but
can
in
I,
terms
can
of...
This is not how like a scientific test works. You're not comparing like with like.
Can I have and this a, isn't a scientific
can,
process.
Can I have an opportunity to try and shit on his argument?
You can
so
try.
Please, defecate all over him.
Right, so you're saying... In your own words, you're sort of saying that you should judge things purely kind of by grades. It doesn't really matter whether somebody comes from a comp or from a
No, that's
school.
Not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that an A student from a comp is not necessarily more impressive than an A student from a private school.
Would you say that if you swap out a comp student versus private school student for a disabled student versus private school student?
Yeah, I'd still say the same.
Oh, then fuck you, basically.
Sorry.
Sorry, but fuck you.
I don't worry. We already have a rating on iTunes. So Jimmy's a dick. Shall we move on to the next topic?
I'm happy to move on to the next topic. I didn't mean to go like quite so out the gates with that one, but you know.
Well, we've gone there.
Wow.
It's fine. Fact listener, if you want to get in touch with Jimmy on Twitter, it's JDE Nichols.
I don't even have your back on this. If you get trolls, fuck it. I don't.
No one tweets us, so it's fine.
Thank fuck for that.
Prove him wrong, listener. Prove him wrong. No death threats, though. He is quite nice.
There you go. So, Brexit trolls.
Oh, speaking of. Well, they're not technically trolls.
Seamless segue. Repitched this topic to me, and I had no idea what he was talking about.
Yeah, but I got all of the terminology wrong. So, researchers from City University of London have identified a network of about 13,000 suspected bots on Twitter that partook in pro-Brexit messages in the run-up to the referendum in 2016, probably of Russian origin. There is now a request for an investigation and review in the British Parliament.
That was Ben Bradshaw, the Labour MP, who asked for that.
And this kind of adds to the whole conversation around influence of social media around Western elections that happened over the past year or so.
Including the Trump,
Macron Le Pen in France, and including the Brexit vote.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Do you believe that this probably happened? Do you think Putin obviously wanted Brexit to happen just as, you know, disintegration of Western power structures, but do you think that he actually went as far as funding this sort of campaign?
It wouldn't surprise me. But also, so I will say, in terms of processes of this type of data scraping, it can sometimes be quite difficult to identify genuine bots on Twitter. What I think is clear is that there was coordination by people outside of the UK to influence the Brexit vote.
Mm.
Where they come from, it's probably Russia, but we don't actually really know whether that means it's from the Kremlin or whether it's from kind of like a wider alt-right decentralized leadership.
Do you think it had an effect on the outcome?
So this is what I think. I don't think that Twitter swung the Brexit vote.
Yeah.
I think it was decades of ignoring the northern working class.
Yeah.
And there could be continued austerity, and I think those are the things that meant that we ended up voting to leave the European Union.
So you're saying Putin wasted his money?
Yeah, probably. Probably wasn't that expensive, to be completely honest.
So
13,000 bots isn't that many.
Why does it matter for us to investigate this sort of thing, then?
Well, because it's a foreign government trying to influence an internal election. That's a really big deal.
Surely, I mean, I would assume that British governments have been trying to influence certainly non-democratic processes, but also democratic processes for many decades.
How do you feel about it? I'm not saying it's okay.
I'm just saying, you know,
as the Brexiter, how does it feel that possibly you're on the same side as Vladimir Putin?
I mean, I'm already on the same side as a lot of fairly unscrupulous individuals.
How does that make you feel?
I don't care. The argument's still good.
So that aside, are you not concerned about the fact that a foreign government, and a malicious foreign government, has possibly tried to influence the democratic process in this country?
I suppose I look at it from a point of view of trying to influence the, you know, fairly the free-for-all that is the internet, and the World Wide Web is a fairly fruitless task anyway. There's certain things that you can do to control what the public sees, but I don't know. They might look into it, and they might find reasonable suspicion to believe that you know, Russian money or Russian government money backed the creation of Twitter bots to try and spread pro-Brexit propaganda. But what do you really do with that information at the end of the day?
I also don't really know how you respond. Do we start meddling with the Russian election that happens next year?
I mean, it's going to be rigged anyway, so, you know, that seems fair.
No, they're a democracy. No.
Sure, okay.
who do you think this lands on the shoulders on? So, Facebook, after Trump has been very vocal at trying to get people to not blame them for the fact that Trump won.
Mm.
While
simultaneously claiming that they, you know, can reach out all types of demographics with their advertising programs.
Yeah. Somebody screenshotted quite a heart-wrenching, well, not heart-wrenching, but quite a funny ad that was being circulated by Facebook on their newsfeed that said, "Who do you trust in terms of advertising?" And it had Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Google, YouTube, and it was basically like, "Do you like us? Why don't you like us? Why do you like Google more than us? Please love me." And it all seemed a little bit desperate. But a lot of that has fallen, I think, partially because Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, is such a visible individual. A lot of that has been kind of like put on his shoulders, and it's like it's Zuck's fault.
Mm.
Whereas Twitter doesn't have a face.
Jack Dorsey's the
No, but like he isn't. He is, but he's not like a public figure in the same way that Zuckerberg is.
He's not a household name.
No, exactly.
And neither is really Sergey Brin or Larry Page, the Google founders.
Yeah, the Google guys. Yeah. Do you think that Twitter should be held as accountable for allowing this kind of stuff and this hijacking to happen as much as Facebook has with its Facebook ads?
This is kind of like part of the wider argument that Twitter and Facebook are basically publishers, but like to pretend that they're not,
mm-hmm.
because there's a whole load of liability that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they are publishers.
And we should say that
basically.
they campaign very strongly against being defined as publishers.
Yeah, well, because if you're a publisher, you have to take some sort of responsibility for what your output is. And obviously people use Twitter and Facebook to put out terrorist messages, to put out illegal pornography, to, you know, put out pretty much anything, and, you know, sales of online drugs or online sales of drugs, all
mm-hmm.
sorts of different things. And I mean, it has been the case that Facebook has been far and Twitter have been far more vigilant in actually creating processes to combat
Twitter have.
Yeah, I mean, Jack Dorsey actually revealed that they would be upping the ante in some mysterious way against online abuse and that sort of thing. The trouble is that traditional publishers have like manual processes for putting out content, and if you're mm-hmm. Facebook or Twitter, it's
yeah, everything has to go through an editorial.
Yeah, yeah, it's all automated for the if you're a social media giant.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that the flagging has to be automated as well, just to keep up with the sheer volume.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, a lot of it is going to slip through, I think. But then that sort of brings us back to the original point that the internet is a free-for-all. So,
do you think it should be a free-for-all? Do you think that we've seen the consequences of a freedom of speech internet, and now, I mean, we hear this kind of stuff from Theresa May in the UK all of the time.
Well, May's always been a bit of a fascist as far as free
speech
goes.
I mean, she's not a fan of an open internet.
No.
Shall we say.
Admittedly, the open internet has never really existed in absolute terms. And I think,
but in much... It definitely created a lot of the media and kind of like social media giants that we have now. Like
yeah.
That free-for-all... Like,
but I mean, even, you know, China has its own internet, more or less.
Yeah, they have an intranet, essentially.
Yeah, because they have a wall around, which you can get through, it's permeable, but...
You jump over it, actually.
Okay,
is,
fine.
Is the common parlance.
Right, fine. And, you know, even in the UK, there's a lot of illicit websites that are blocked from access for your average user who isn't using a virtual private network
mm-hmm.
or something like that. So, to a significant degree, that's already happened, but... I do think that the internet has to remain... I think the benefits of it remaining largely free and people just being allowed to put out roughly what they want do outweigh the costs. But then
even when those costs are foreign interventions in democratic elections.
Yeah.
Wow. John,
there's no way of like totally eliminating foreign influence in...
No, of course, but
elections.
I think that...
So
I think
you say that, one of the things that interests me about this is they've managed to identify these 13,000 bots. Surely there are people who are intelligent enough to write an algorithm that could, if not stop bots putting something out, at least flag that content for review.
Well, they did that for ISIS-related content.
And that is kind of basically the process that happens, but it is very hit and miss.
it can be very difficult, especially when you kind of have an arms race where the people who are creating the automated processes that create bots have kind of figured out ways of being able to make them look like genuine accounts. And so it becomes really difficult for the host platform to be able to identify them effectively. Which is why, actually, these 13,000 bots were removed after the election, after the referendum. I don't know, man. I worry. I like the idea of there being a free-for-all internet, but then I also see how easy it is kind of becoming to get Donald Trump elected. For example,
I mean, do you think that the Russian influence was key in the Donald Trump getting elected?
I think it was more so in the US than it was in Brexit.
I'd agree with that, yeah.
I think that there are a lot of similar things, but
The allegation is that, you know, the Russian administration was directly in contact with Trump's campaign.
I mean,
so it's not just the
we'll see that shit show explode in the next year or
it's
so.
It's not just like some house, Twitter right? meddling. Is it?
Mm. How do we feel about something that I think is actually quite similar, and the fact that political ads are not regulated?
This is in the UK
nearly
context.
As much in the UK or in the US.
I mean,
there are fewer regulations for political ads in the US.
I think that's a bit of a fucking joke. I think in any medium, political ads should be regulated. Really. I don't think they're strictly enough regulated in the US.
They're not really.
No. In the UK, you have obviously, in terms of television and radio, you have quite strict rules.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't really apply so much online.
Yeah.
And I think it should apply online.
It certainly should, yeah.
But I'm not sure how that's enforceable when you're able to run ads, especially on Twitter and Facebook, that are targeted to specific people. And so they aren't something that is viewed by everyone and therefore cannot be critiqued or taken down by everybody.
I don't
know. That is true, but you can still limit the amount of spending from central.
Yeah. But then when you are perhaps hiring somebody from abroad to like maybe the Kremlin, or when you have foreign influences buying advertising and creating bots to have influence in another country, then any kind of regulation that is within that country is kind of blown out the water and made obsolete.
Well, also, I think it would be difficult to actually stop third-party groups affiliated with, say, the Tories or Labour from advertising or promoting the parties.
Well, I mean,
separately.
If you look at the last election in the UK, arguably Jeremy Corbyn wouldn't have made nearly as...
Without their ad campaign.
Exactly.
Facebook and Instagram ads.
They reached out to people very well on social media. But I still think it should be regulated. It's not up to me to decide how that should be regulated. There are people who are employed to do that kind of thing, but I think it should be regulated online, definitely.
I mean,
it seems to me it's
a bit aimless to suggest something should be regulated
if you have no idea how it should be regulated. It's fucking insane to regulate things on TV and radio, but not online.
I agree with that, yeah.
That's absolutely insane.
And it's just our legislation hasn't yet caught up
with that
digital phenomenon. But so, for example, Germany has very different publishing rules to the rest of the world. They have much stricter ones, especially when it comes to Nazi-focused content. And so places like Twitter and Facebook have to have separate functioning kind of like bodies that regulate for that kind of content. And so maybe that's just something that these platforms are going to have to pump an awful lot more local money into in order to try and stop this kind of hijacking of another country's political discourse. There's my solution.
But then again, maybe
seeing as you hate people not having solutions.
Yeah.
John can identify, I'll come up with how we fix it.
Yeah. Maybe you should start your own political party.
No, I hate that idea. I should be put nowhere near power, ever.
Well, there's something we can agree on. Should we turn to Cambridge and trigger warnings?
I turn to Cambridge.
Right, I'll just read out the headline that was on the BBC. Cambridge uni students get Shakespeare trigger warnings. I'll let that sit like a fart in the wind.
So yeah, the basic idea is that, I mean, trigger warnings aren't anything new at universities. It's been happening in the US for years and years and years. It's been happening over here for years and years and
Give an example of a trigger warning. Not that many of our listeners will not know what a trigger warning is.
So the specific, one of the specific things that was reported on at Cambridge University is there is now a trigger warning for plays including Sarah Kane's Blasted, Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors, and Titus Andronicus, because a lecture about it would involve discussions of sexual violence and sexual assault. So you know, there's a trigger warning placed on a handout that students will receive about the upcoming lecture series. It's not a sort of policy by Cambridge University. It's a policy that was adopted by a lecturer. Cambridge University don't have a blanket policy that they enforce.
So the headline is false.
Yeah, it is false. Great. To a degree.
It's acceptably misleading.
It says the journalist.
But, you know, I mean, equally, there is a discussion to be had because some people think it's got quite out of control in America. The idea of, should we have trigger warnings at university? Should we have trigger warnings about certain texts, archaic texts? Should, because in America, on certain campuses, I think including Berkeley, it's led to certain texts being banned from being studied because it might have sensitive material. And, you know, how do we feel about this? Could this be the thin end of the wedge over here?
I don't understand that phrase, thin end of
the
wedge.
It's a slippery slope.
Oh, slippery slope. Yeah.
Same thing.
Ball carrying moss, something. Yeah. But so you've identified two separate things, and we were talking about this earlier, and you seem concerned that this means that Shakespeare is going to get taken off of the curriculum and these topics aren't going to be discussed. But those are two very different things. Providing a trigger warning for your class, because you may have people in that cohort that have experienced sexual assault and have not been able, are not yet, for want of a better word, over it, or have not yet gone through the processes to like heal properly from it, I think that they should have the right to check themselves out from any discussions about those kinds of topics. What I agree with you on is that I don't think that means that these kinds of texts should be removed from syllabuses, but just give people fair warning so that they can make a proper decision.
I mean, the problem is, this is a quote from Professor Dennis Haynes from Derby University. He said, once you get a few trigger warnings...
Great guy.
Lecturers will stop preventing anything that is controversial. Gradually, there is no critical discussion.
But that isn't what is happening. If that started happening, then I would have a problem with it. But allowing people to check out on a topic that might be distressing for them, I think it's totally fine.
Doesn't it create an incentive for lecturers to steer away from controversial material?
Why would it?
You say that. The problem is
they want people to study their course.
Yeah, the problem is...
The lecturers I know actually quite enjoy it when fewer people turn up to their courses.
Maybe I'm totally wrong then.
The problem is that, you know, previous evidence from America has shown that introduction of trigger warnings leads to things like text being banned from curriculum.
But it doesn't need to. You're allowed to have that safety net for people who could be, for want of a better word, triggered by this kind of stuff. And not go the next step to banning these texts completely and pretending that we live in a world of rainbows and unicorns.
I feel very conflicted about the idea of trigger warnings. As somebody who suffers with mental health issues and has been through therapy many times, because, I mean, trigger warnings were invented specifically for people with mental health issues to address their difficulties. What worries me is that wider society are adopting the concept of trigger warnings to say this might be controversial. It's becoming a synonym for controversial.
But I feel like trigger warnings have kind of always existed, especially in the world of academia, but they've just only recently been called trigger warnings because Tumblr exists. And so people have had on the front page, on like the introduction to courses, saying that in this course we are going to discuss, FYI, we're going to discuss rape, sexual harassment, and gender dysphoria and blah, 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 blah. If you are somebody who is not comfortable talking about those issues for various reasons, then just don't take the course.
But, I mean, that's not what's happened. It's happened on a...
But isn't that what's happening here at Cambridge?
No, because it's like a class-by-class basis. Now, I would
but
be more...
But that's also...
I'd be more in favour of don't come on this general module if any of these issues will be a problem for you, than I would of individual texts.
Why? I don't understand
because
why that's a different thing.
In terms of academia, as I'm sure you appreciate, you have to have a holistic view of things. You have to be able to pick and choose your arguments from different texts. And you, for example, some of the texts that are flagged up in this include texts by Euripides, the Bacchae,
you're naming so many like texts, and the only one I've recognised is Shakespeare. To be completely honest,
but for example, a very specific case, Serapion's Blasted. It's written by a woman who went through some horrific experiences, and it's very much about trying to confront the audience with the brutal reality of how horrible these experiences
can be. And probably someone who has perhaps recently gone through that experience shouldn't have to go through it, reliving it.
Are you saying that like students should be obliged to read certain things in the context of a course?
I believe that's called a syllabus.
Well, yeah, is that what you're saying?
I suppose I'm coming at it from a slightly different angle. I don't think you should get off reading something that could be distressing, if the whole point of said text is that you're meant to be confronted by something that is difficult.
No, but it's not the fact that it's difficult. I'm sure, unless you're doing a whole course on like the history of like sexual assault in English literature, for example, and that's a core course of the studies that you're doing, then it's going to be quite difficult to be able to avoid that. But if that's just like one section of history of feminism in literature, then there are going to be loads of other angles that you're going to be able to pick up and contribute to. Right. That's not necessarily go. And
it just
also,
it seems to me, like just you've given that example, it would be quite strange to study feminism in literature without studying some texts involving rape and sexual assault.
So I feel like often the people who are affected by these kinds of events, from my experience anyway, are very rarely the purple-haired social justice warrior person who I think that is a caricature doesn't hold an awful lot of weight. Yeah, a lot of these people want to be able to talk about these things, and so being able to have like a dialogue the way that it's done at my school is that they encourage people to come to the lecturer separately and try and figure out a way that they'd be able to address it in a way that would be beneficial to the student who possibly wouldn't want to do it in a public class setting.
Do you not think?
But it's really difficult to put that kind of nuanced solution forward in a news article about hashtag trigger warnings.
I mean, do you not think, though, that there are instances at universities where sort of social justice warriors will refuse to turn up to a lecture?
Yeah, sure, but that's on them. We're customers now as students because we have to pay fees. We're not obliged, and I actually think that dynamic is quite positive in terms of demanding stuff from your institution and your lecturers and your professors. And if you don't want to turn up to something, the only person that you're kind of like affecting is you and your own academic career. That's the person's decision.
Are you though? I mean, because if consistently people protest certain texts being on,
but we're not talking about protesting certain texts.
No, but not in the UK yet. But as I said, it's happened in America.
I don't know. I'd love to. Like, I just don't think that that's going to happen. And if it does start happening, then I'll have a criticism of it, and I will obviously not be happy about it.
Right.
But I think that this is just something similar. Imagine being, and this has happened to me, imagine being on the in a classroom and then somebody starts talking about suicide and you're not prepared for it. This has definitely happened to me, and I've had to leave the room because I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't in the right state of mind at the time, and so I was like, I need to check out and have a cigarette, and had to leave. I would have really appreciated the ability to kind of like ready myself for it at least,
sure,
or leave beforehand.
You do raise sort of a good point against your general view though, in that in a discussion about a text, anything could come up and you might not be ready for it.
See, like, I mean, part of my...
No, but so this was... So people
in this particular context, people were presenting topics that they were doing for their theses. Mm. And so what was being discussed was not laid out beforehand. And then the person dived into talking about who here has knows somebody who's committed suicide. I mean, and I was like, nope,
as
bye.
As a counter to your argument, though, as somebody who's survived numerous suicide attempts, do you not think it sort of furthers social stigma and taboo to not talk about these things in open sessions?
I would be really happy. So for me, in that particular situation, totally happy to talk about that kind of stuff. But let me ready myself for like the hit,
discussion.
You know, don't just blindside me with a left hook. Let me get my gloves up and boxing analogies.
Because I think it's a very delicate, you know, there was the thing with 13 Reasons Why a few months ago. A lot of
the
people,
Netflix series.
I haven't yet watched it, so I speak from a position of
which
ignorance.
Is about
suicide. Basically, it's based on a book. The premise is that a young woman who commits suicide leaves 13 tapes for somebody to listen through.
Conveniently, there are 13 episodes.
Yeah, and you know, it had depictions of self-harm and suicide, which wouldn't have got past Ofcom guidelines, but you know, were allowed to be published on Netflix, and a lot of charities argued that it was very irresponsible, etc. I mean, as I said, I haven't watched it yet, so I can't comment on the specific content, but if you read the Ofcom guidelines, they're very restrictive on, you know, the idea of publishing basically anything about self-harm and suicide. And I
because of copycat.
Find this very distressing as somebody who's been in that state of mind, because I would have found it incredibly helpful if somebody was talking about something like that in very sort of blunt and real terms.
But then you should be able to seek it out.
But
right?
You have that. I mean, you've got that dynamic with it.
But then, so many people are not going to be in that state of mind where they are willing and ready to accept that kind of like challenging nature. And so that's why I think that people should be able to seek it out. Yes, that information should be there, and those discussions should be there. But they shouldn't be thrown at people.
But I mean, you know, going back to the Netflix series, it's not compulsive viewing, is it? You know, actually, I think there were warnings at the beginning of each episode to say this contains depictions of yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. So that's in favour of
trigger warnings.
Yeah. Isn't that exactly... So that's like a closed network that people don't have to go into. And then when you're in that situation, when you're watching something like 13 Reasons Why... 13 reasons. Like you have gone into it knowing exactly what is going, is going to be addressed in that situation.
Netflix,
right?
to me, Netflix is very different to an academic discussion of things, because Netflix is like an entertainment thing.
Netflix has a way bigger audience.
But then you have you have like a virtual room that you consent to go into. When you're in Netflix, and in a lecture, you have a physical room that you consent to go into. And you should know what's inside that room when you're studying.
Right.
And that should be... Like, it doesn't need to be a fucking trigger warning. It can just be a, this is what we're going to talk about. And the student can be allowed to not go to that lecture.
I think that would be more appropriate than...
It's the same thing.
No, but I think nuance matters. Because in an academic context, I think that nuance matters. Because
it's a fucking label on a lecture.
No, because
you know,
look, the difference is that when you put a trigger warning on something, there are people who are not sophisticated enough, even at universities, to understand exactly what trigger warnings mean. And
it's a fucking warning. This contains nuts. Label.
Yeah,
that's what it fucking is.
That's exactly what it is.
But
thank you.
In an academic context.
No bullshit. That. How fucking retarded are these kids? Like, they'll work it out.
Retarded. How many times do I have to tell you? Don't use retarded.
I'm going to continue.
It is 2017.
I'm going to continue to use the word retarded. How dumb are these kids? And why the fuck are they at uni if they're this fucking dumb?
Oh, there are a lot of stupid people at university. Definitely.
Ah, but all you want is for Exhibit A to be replaced with Exhibit B, which is the same as Exhibit A, but some of the wording is mildly tweaked.
Yeah, I kind of think that this,
it doesn't matter. It does not matter.
Fine. If we one day reach a world where people are refusing to study things like
surveys, it will not be because we put trigger warnings on things. I can guarantee you that world may one day exist, and I will be on your side of the argument then. But it will not be because we decided to warn people that certain topics.
It scares me that this is the thin end of the wedge.
John, I think I'm more pro free speech than you, or at least as pro free speech as you, and I don't give a shit about this.
Right, okay.
So, I'm just saying, you know.
Excellent. Shall we wrap up?
No worries. I mean, free speech doesn't happen at unis anyway, so, you know, it's fine. It doesn't matter.
Kind of my point.
John, where can they find you on the internet if they want? What's your Twitter handle this month?
It's at JC Savant. I'm actually about to publish a series about mental health and stuff like that on YouTube.
Relevant.
So watch out for that coming soon. Coming to a YouTube channel near you.
As in virtually, yeah. Jimmy, where can they find you?
As you previously pointed out, at JDE Nichols.
Yep, please send all hate mail there. I can be found at Jazza John. Leave us a review on iTunes. It helps us out immensely, and we always enjoy reading them and occasionally reading them out. To all of our Patreons, there's going to be some extra content going up this week. Very exciting, but you must be a patron in order to be able to do so. Ooh, teasers! Go on.
Where can people go to patronise us?
It's patreon.com/rightdishonourable, but also just Google Patreon, Right Dishonourable, and it'll come up. You can also find us on Twitter, at Right Dishonour.
We do have a website, rightdishonourable.com.
So there's now definitely too many actions, and nobody's going to do anything. Anyway, love you lots. Speak to you later. Toodaloo.
Bye-bye.